the attitude was, they're out of sight, they're out of mind, nobody knows, nobody cares, they're expensive to clean up, so we're not going to do it.
The state presses the BLM to clean up the so-called legacy wells. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a high school senior sues the state over climate change impacts.
In the springtime, we lost about 8 feet, and not too far after that, in the summertime, we lost about 5 feet.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
The Interior Department is expected to finalize its management plan for the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska this month. The proposed plan sets aside half of the reserve for environmental protection. The state has several grievances against the federal government over the NPRA, but one of the thorniest issues involves dozens of exploratory oil and gas wells the government drilled decades ago but did not properly clean up. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
A three-ring binder the size of a toaster oven sits on a small table in Kathy Forrester's office in downtown Anchorage. The chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission wants easy access to information on each of the Bureau of Land Management's so-called legacy wells. There are 126 of them.
Okay, the notebook contains, for every well, it contains a picture of what the surface looks like, and most of those are not very pretty. You know, some of them have just a wellhead, some of them have.
Forrester is from Texas, a fact she is quick to point out. And in Texas, orphan wells, where companies drill for oil, go bankrupt, and then leave the well without cleaning up, are a big problem. So when she first joined the commission in 2005, she wondered if there were many orphan wells in Alaska.
So, you know, I was quickly able to determine that the only problem we have in the state, other than, you know, the three or four wells that don't have an operator we can go back on, the only problem in the state is the one created by the federal government.
That problem is mostly in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, which is managed by the Bureau of Land Management. The exploratory wells were drilled by federal agencies from 1944 to 1982 to assess the oil and gas potential in the area. Alaska is the only state where federal legacy wells exist. Most of the wells have been left untouched for decades. One near Barrow is nicknamed the Whistling Well because it occasionally still releases gas. And Forrester says even the surface of many of the drill sites are an environmental mess.
One well site has hundreds of drums, barrels that were left at one time filled with something, you know, drilling mud, chemicals, who knows what. But all of those hundreds of drums have corroded and are now empty. And all whatever was there has leached into the tundra. And the drums are still out there rusting away.
In 7 years since Forrester first approached BLM about the problem, the two agencies haven't even come to terms on which wells need acute attention and which ones can be left alone. She says it's been difficult to get basic information from BLM on the status of the wells. Forrester was hopeful a U.S. Senate hearing on the issue this July would speed up the process, but that hasn't happened.
The attitude was, they're out of sight, they're out of mind, nobody knows, nobody cares, they're expensive to clean up, so we're not going to do it.
But the BLM is working to address the problem wells, although the pace of work is slow. Since 2004, the agency has cleaned up six of the highest priority wells for $60 million. The state has questions about whether that work was completed to industry standards. Ted Murphy is the Associate State Director of BLM. He says the state is exaggerating the environmental threat the wells pose.
Honestly, I think there's been some misrepresentation on the status of the wells.
Murphy acknowledges many of the wells look bad. They have an optics problem, in his words. But he says
it's not a big environmental risk.
Murphy says BLM is monitoring the wells to make sure they don't deteriorate to the point where they do become an environmental risk. And this month, the agency is planning to release a strategy for properly plugging and abandoning the remaining wells. The agency hopes to address 13 wells in the next 4 years if they can find funding.
The BLM and the Department of Interior are taking this very seriously. And we're also moving with a pragmatic approach to completion of this.
When the Interior Department makes NPRA available for oil leasing, it can require companies to clean up the legacy wells as a condition of the leases. But under the proposed plan for developing NPRA, only about a quarter of the wells are on land available for leasing. Kathy Forrester was furious when Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, who likes wearing cowboy hats, announced that so much of the reserve would be set aside for wilderness protection.
Excuse me, if you're going to get on your high horse with your pretty hat and say that you've got to protect this iconic piece of wilderness, then you need to clean up the messes that you're responsible for first.
At the rate the BLM is working, Forrester is not optimistic those legacy well messes will be cleaned up anytime soon. And she suspects that hefty three-ring binder will be sitting on her office table as long as she's a commissioner. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Plans for a 29-mile pipeline underneath Cook Inlet were announced last week. Cook Inlet Energy, one of many new players in the area, is the company applying for a right-of-way lease from the Department of Natural Resources. As KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, an underwater pipeline would solve several problems for Cook Inlet oil producers, but other concerns remain.
First, the pipeline. A 29-mile horseshoe-shaped 8-inch line from Cook Inlet Energy's Kustatan production facility on West Foreland Point, directly across the inlet from Nikiski, will travel south for several miles to avoid deep trenches and fast currents and finally connect at the Tesoro refinery in Nikiski. The line's maximum depth will be 200 feet, according to CIE's project description, which also describes the project's purpose as necessary to, quote, bypass the aging infrastructure on the west side of Cook Inlet to eliminate risk of volcanic activity and ice movements to oil shipments. That's been the main reason people have been pushing for a pipeline since Mount Redoubt erupted last in 2009, exposing the risks associated with the nearby Drift River storage terminal. With its storage capacity compromised after that eruption, tanker traffic in the inlet increased to keep production moving from one side of the inlet to the other. This summer, the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council, or CIRCAC, released a position paper in support of a pipeline, which CIRCAC Executive Director Michael Munger said at the time would be much easier to manage in the event of a disaster or spill.
One of the studies that's being done within the Cook Inlet Risk Assessment points towards if there is going to be an accident in Cook Inlet and marine vessel traffic, the highest environmental risk is tanker traffic. And so we'd like to see them get out of that system. But again, ultimately, what we'd like to see is the pipeline installed. We feel a five-year time frame is a reasonable time to get the studies done and the engineering done to get this installed.
They might not have to wait that long. Construction is scheduled for April through August of 2014. The line will have the capacity to carry up to 90,000 barrels of oil per day. Cook Inlet oil production was about 10,000 barrels per day in 2011. Hillcorp, who operates the Drift River storage terminal, could be one of the companies to benefit from the lowered costs of production anticipated to come with the new pipeline. Hillcorp spokesperson Lori Nelson told the Peninsula Clarion Wednesday that there are too many ifs right now to speculate on any agreement, but that they encourage CIE's success on the project. While the pipeline mitigates the potential for oil spills in an increasingly busy production center, environmentalists and others still have plenty of concerns. Bob Shavelson is the director of advocacy for the Cook Inlet Keeper. A pipeline has been on their wish list for some time. Despite what a pipeline might mean for tanker travel in the inlet, he says regulations here still lag behind other parts of the state.
You know, it's great. We have one high-powered tug around the Tesoro docks that sees service in various areas, but we have nothing near the capacity that you see in Prince William Sound or elsewhere. So we're really in kind of a regulatory backwater here, and if there is a serious problem with a vessel that loses power or runs aground, we don't have the capacity to really deal with that.
Andy says many environmental concerns remain, specifically related to toxic discharges into the inlet.
It's kind of a throwback to the fact that Cook Inlet Oil and Gas production preceded the major federal environmental laws. It preceded the Clean Water Act, which was passed by Congress in 1972. So they essentially grandfathered in Cook Inlet. So we know this stuff is toxic. We know it's harmful. We don't have to find that needle in a haystack to say, you know, this discharge caused this toxic effect. Let's not dump it. Let's put it back down the hole where it came from. And I think that's good business.
Cook Inlet Energy estimates cost of the pipeline at $50 million. The public has until February 4th to submit comments to the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office at spco.records.alaska.gov. Reporting from Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Two people have died in Bethel in cold, abandoned buildings, but no official cause of the deaths have been confirmed. From Member Station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The latest was 60-year-old June Swope, who was found unresponsive Friday morning inside of an old, unheated building at 102 East Avenue. The call came into the Bethel Police Station at about 11 a.m. When police and medics arrived on the scene, Swope was cold to the touch. Medics attempted to treat her and transported her to the hospital in Bethel, where she was later pronounced dead. 4 days earlier, Norbert Kashatuk of Bethel was found in an unheated home near Mission Road. His friend was unable to rouse him and informed the police. That was just before 2 a.m. Medics found Kashatuk lying down inside the building with no pulse. They attempted to treat him, but he was later pronounced dead at the hospital. Kashatuk might have been attempting to stay in the old house, possibly with others. In both cases, Bethel police are not investigating because they say no foul play is suspected. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, growing oysters from seed.
At about 2 millimeters, the naked eye can see that there's actually something going on there. And when we ship them out at 5 millimeters, you can see that they are teeny little oysters at that point.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
This week, Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest is offering free HIV testing in 4 Alaska locations. It started today. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
The free HIV testing is available at Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Soldotna Planned Parenthood Health Centers. Clover Simon is a spokesperson for Planned Parenthood in Anchorage. She says this is the first time the organization has been able to provide free testing statewide for a full week.
We haven't had the opportunity to do this in the past. We're using a special fund this year that is a donor-initiated fund for services, and so we're able to offer free testing for this week, and we're doing it in honor of World AIDS Day, which was December 1st, as a way to continue to remind our patients and the public that knowing your status is the best prevention for HIV.
Simon says you can just walk into any of the locations to get a test. You have 2 choices, she says, and it doesn't take long.
We are offering both the oral test as well as a blood draw. The advantages to the oral test is that you're basically just taking a swab of your gums, and we can give you the results within 20 minutes, which is fantastic. It doesn't involve any needles for folks that are afraid of the needle stick.
The swab test is fairly accurate, but a positive result would have to be confirmed by a blood test. Blood tests are nearly 100% accurate. It takes about a week to get those results back. There were 24 cases of HIV diagnosed in Alaska in 2011, bringing the number of known cases to 61. Simon says 8 of those cases were related to an outbreak of HIV in Fairbanks.
The state rolled in right away and did some investigation and was able to isolate and tested many partners. And that, as far as I know, that outbreak has been contained. But I think that's the issue with small communities and with rural populations and the small populations in Alaska is if you have one positive person and you have situations where there's people sharing needles, if it's intravenous drug use or people having multiple anonymous sex partners, it's very easy to transmit HIV.
Simon says part of the reason Planned Parenthood is offering the free HIV tests is to prevent another such outbreak. There have been just under 1,500 documented cases of HIV in Alaska since 1982, when the state began tracking it. Besides the free testing at the four Planned Parenthood locations this week, HIV testing is also available on a sliding scale at public health centers and village clinics statewide. Alaska Native beneficiaries do not pay when they get tested at village clinics. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A high school senior from Western Alaska is suing the state. 18-year-old Nelson Canuck is the lead plaintiff in a case about climate change. The lawsuit says Alaska's government is not doing its part to deal with the problem. KCAW's Ed Ronco has the story.
The snow is coming later in Kipnuk. The river does not stay frozen all winter, and the riverbank is quickly eroding. Those are just a few of the changes Nelson Canuck says he sees in his Western Alaska hometown.
My house back in Kipnuk, we live right in front of the riverbank.
Nelson says the permafrost that used to hold the bank in place is melting. He's watched the river move closer to the bright green house he shares with his parents and five siblings. He and his father, William, have taken measurements.
In the springtime, we lost about 8 feet. And not too far after that, in the summertime, we lost about 5 feet. And so now I'm not sure how much closer it has been because I've been here at school in Sitka.
Nelson is one of six Alaska youth being represented by the organization Our Children's Trust. The Oregon-based nonprofit filed lawsuits on behalf of young plaintiffs in 9 states. A separate suit is pending against the federal government, and there are a few international cases too. The lawsuits ask their respective governments to consider the atmosphere a public trust and exercise their duty to protect it. Eagle River attorney Brad DeNoble represents the Alaska plaintiffs, including Nelson.
Unfortunately, he is the perfect plaintiff.
DeNoble says he uses the word unfortunately because climate change could have serious effects on Nelson and his family.
Where Nelson lives in Kipnuk, the tundra and the ocean is, as he has described, is basically their supermarket. From an actual gathering of food to a culture to a way of life, climate change is significantly and severely impacting that.
The original suit was filed in 2011, but dismissed earlier this year in Anchorage Superior Court. Judge Sen Tan essentially ruled climate policy is not an issue for the courts, but for the political process, the legislature, and the executive branch. In appeal papers filed with the Supreme Court in November, DeNoble says his clients did not ask the court to set a specific policy, but rather to tell the state it has a responsibility to do something. It wants Alaska to encourage a 6% annual reduction in carbon dioxide beginning next year. The Our Children's Trust lawsuit is against the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, but it was Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner Larry Hartig who returned KCAW's phone call. He said he couldn't speak directly to the lawsuit, but that Alaska has taken steps to address climate change and continues to do so. He cites examples like rock walls that were put up to help communities facing erosion issues. And the state has helped develop disaster plans for places like Kivalina, a northwest Alaska coastal community battered by autumn storms 5 years ago. As for reducing emissions by 6% a year, as the Our Children's Trust group recommends, well, Hartig says making a dent that big would probably mean massive changes to oil and gas production, as well as air and marine travel. And much of that, like the kinds of fuel airliners can use, is out of the state's control. Reducing greenhouse gas emissions into the future is important, Hartig says. But even if that happens, what's already been done will continue to have consequences.
Again, if we all shut off our carbon emissions tomorrow, what's in the atmosphere is in the atmosphere now. And this is, again, I say if the scientists are right, and I'm not a climate scientist, if they're right, then that warming is going to continue. So it means that we have to adapt.
Back in Sitka, Nelson Canuck hopes adaptation does not mean his family will have to move from Kipnuk.
That is where my family grew up, and that is where my ancestors have lived. And we're coming into a new world where many cultures are constantly changing. But I believe it's important to keep our feet in our homeland and remember our roots and remember our traditional values.
For now, those things are on solid ground. Whether they stay that way will depend on the river. And what happens next will depend on the Alaska Supreme Court. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Federal Aviation Administration setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Shellfish farmers in Alaska need seed, and a Ketchikan facility is gearing up to meet that demand. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
Ocean's Alaska Marine Science Center completed its first season of operation this year, successfully producing hundreds of thousands of shellfish seed. Barbara Morgan, research and training specialist, says the first year was successful enough that the Ketchikan-based center is expanding operations.
This year we ended up with about 300,000 oyster seed, which seems like a lot, but the demand is in the millions in Alaska. Not only is the demand really big in Alaska, we were receiving calls from British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, and as far south as Southern California.
Roger Painter of the Alaska Shellfish Growers Association agrees there's a seed shortage.
We estimate the industry got about 40% of what it needed this year, and last year the figure was at 48%.
Painter says the expanded production next year should meet the current demand. There's one other shellfish hatchery in Alaska, Aleutic Pride in Seward. That facility, too, plans to expand. The shortage appears to be the result of ocean acidification. Oceans Alaska will continue with seed production at its current facility for at least one more season to help satisfy demand in Alaska alone. But Morgan says it won't be enough.
Demand is growing. The mariculture industry, we would like to have, it wants to grow. It's kind of at a tipping point right now. Either it grows and gets past the seed shortage issue, or it may tip back, and we don't want it to tip back. So we would like to actually build a bigger facility, 3 or 4 times bigger.
The planned new facility would produce up to 50 million oyster seed and 1 million geoduck seed for Alaska shellfish farmers. Morgan says that industry has big potential, especially for people in small coastal communities.
It's a great economic development potential here in Southeast Alaska in particular. Small communities out in the middle of nowhere, which I'm from one of them, so I can say that.
Which one are you from?
I grew up in Edna Bay. So, and then Nocatee, Kaufman Cove, you know, a lot of small places have oyster farmers around them already, Cake, Huna, wherever, but they need to have the support to really grow, and this could actually be the economic support for some of those small communities that are kind of in an economic slump right now.
Painter says there are 75 permits for shellfish farms in Alaska, but only about 25 of those are active. Of the active permits, about 15 are in Southeast.
But there are a number of additional farms in Southeast that aren't selling yet, but have animals in the water and are moving in that direction.
For example, Huna and Angoon are developing new oyster farms. Painter says they and others all will need seed. Morgan described how Oceans Alaska grows oyster seed, or SPAT. It's complex and starts with a pile of fertilized shellfish eggs purchased from outside.
The life stages of an oyster is that after fertilization, they develop into a free-swimming larva stage. And they can be transported pretty easily at that point. They can be...
So where do you get those?
We get those from a company in Washington, Coast Seafoods, and they ship them up. They look like a big ball of wet sand.
The larvae are put into a tank where they swim around for a while eating algae, which Morgan grows at the facility. Then, the tiny oysters want to set on something. Oceans Alaska crews grind up oyster shell and put it on the bottom of the tanks. That provides an anchor for developing oysters.
It looks like sand on top of sand to the naked eye. You need to use a microscope at that point to be able to see that there is actually something going on.
The microscopic oysters form their own shells, continue eating Morgan's high-quality algae, and grow. Depending on the species, oysters need 2 to 4 years before the first harvest. In Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
UA Regents received an update late last week on a range of research going on at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. As KUAC's Nan Bross reports, technology is at the center of activity.
Geophysical Institute Director Dr. Robert McCoy identifies unmanned aerial vehicle, or UAV-related projects, as one of the areas of major growth.
The new opportunities are coming in so fast we almost can't keep up.
McCoy says UAF is already involved in glacier, sea ice, marine mammal, and other UAV surveys where the aircraft provide a cheaper, lower-risk way to work in remote areas. McCoy says the university is well-positioned to become home to UAV test centers being developed by the Federal Aviation Administration.
There's an issue with the FAA of separating the airspace. There's manned airspace and unmanned airspace, and the FAA is a little bit nervous about it. So what better place to do that than Alaska? And we're out in the front of this, leading the way in how to work with the FAA and how to do things responsibly and reliably.
McCoy also highlighted UAF's development of a small satellite with NASA. He says the 4-inch cube satellite will track environmental conditions from launch all the way into space.
Most CubeSats don't turn on until they're in orbit. So I think we're going to have the first CubeSat ever turned on before launch. That's sort of a new paradigm. But beyond that, we want to build a lot more. So we're reaching out to partner to develop and fly more of these for space weather, for lots of applications. The next one on the books is something to look for volcanoes.
UAF is also working the receiving side with the development of 2 new satellite dishes, one with NASA on campus and another planned for location at Eielson Air Force Base. McCoy says the university will own the Eielson dish, broadening its enterprise opportunity with outside institutions and agencies like the Department of Defense.
We're open to, A, address a lot of the educational capabilities for downlinking data from small satellites and work with a number of universities, but B, downlink data that we can share with the DOD and even for research and other applications in the Arctic.
McCoy says the focus of the world is shifting to the Arctic due to climate change and other issues, and UAF is well positioned to take advantage of it. He says it'll enable the university to better weather an expected downturn in federal research dollars. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Annie Fite reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Crowley, working in Alaska for over 50 years. Crowley understands the importance of safe and reliable fuel delivery in Western Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and is proud to support public radio. CPDAlaska.com. Enroll now and get a career in less than a year in refrigeration, marine oiler, heavy equipment, or welding. Additional training programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January. This message sponsored by Avtech.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.